Hi, I'd like to welcome everyone to today's call to discuss how local governments can thrive in uncertain times. We're joined today by a range of speakers gathered at the 96th Annual Conference of ICMA, the International City-County Management Association, which is taking place in San Jose, California, October 17th through the 20th. We will hear today from an array of local government policy experts and practitioners. Ron Carley, the Chief Operating Officer at ICMA and the former County Manager in Arlington County, Virginia. Elizabeth Keller, Executive Director of the Center for State and Local Government Excellence and Deputy Executive Director at ICMA. Darnell Early, the current President of ICMA and City Manager in Saginaw, Michigan. Chris Fabian, Senior Manager at the Center for Priority-Based Budgeting. Linda Barton, City Manager in Livermore, California, and John Johnson, Senior Manager, Center for Priority-Based Budgeting. After hearing remarks from our speakers, we will open up the lines for questions from the assembled press. Now, I'd like to turn the call over to Ron Carley, Chief Operating Officer of ICMA.
Thank you, Michael, and thanks to everyone who is joining with us in the morning or afternoon, depending on where you're located across the country. As hopefully most of you know, ICMA, International City-County Management Association, is the professional association for professional managers serving local governments across the United States and internationally in a number of other countries. We are the professional managers that provide the day-to-day operational oversight for cities, counties, and towns, literally of all sizes. Among our most important responsibilities is ensuring the long-term financial sustainability of our communities. And to say that this responsibility has been challenged over the last 3 years, of course, would be a significant understatement. This morning, our keynote address at ICMA, where we have approaching 3,000 attendees, was Diane Swank. She's a Senior Managing Director and Chief Economist for Mrs. Rowe Financial. She gave us a very sobering presentation. The reality is what we suspected, that, A, nobody really knows what's going to go on. There is tremendous uncertainty in the financial world these days. But what seems to be a consensus emerging is that our recovery is going to be slow and perhaps as long as a decade. She is seeing no change significantly in unemployment over the next year. She believes that retail sales that have been relatively robust, having redefined robust, will not be sustained, and that, among other factors, will lead to additional state and local contraction. And it is, of course, that local contraction and our revenue sharing with the states that are of great concern to us. She also emphasized the importance of education. And, of course, education is mostly a local responsibility. So from a professional manager standpoint, what we're trying to do, as I have heard from managers consistently around the country, is take the long-term view. We've got to get beyond short-term fixes. Accounting tricks are of no significance right now. We really have to use a trite phrase, once again, reinvent government. What we want to do is to right-size, which does include some downsizing, some restructuring, some consolidation, some sharing of services, some outsourcing, all of which are extremely difficult things to do in any environment. But it's part of our responsibility to see beyond the politics of the activity and to really bring forward recommendations that will ensure real financial integrity of our communities, not just for the current generation, but for those for the long term. It's our job to see beyond just the next election cycle. So in doing that, pretty much everything is on the table by all managers. And in fact, what I have found among managers both at the conference and in sessions before the annual conference is not a sense of hopelessness or negativity or pessimism, but an acceptance of a reality that this is our job. And it's our responsibility to step up to the plate and to ensure that our communities for the long term are great places to live and work and to play. Now, among the concerns that we have are major drivers, of course, on the revenue side, which we can only control to a limited extent. On the expenditure side, we're very concerned about the continuing demand on pensions, and pension reform is going to be a significant issue, as Beth Keller will discuss with you. Also, how do we ensure reasonable pay for our employees, many of whom have not only not gotten pay raises, but have suffered furloughs and in some communities even givebacks? We think part of the key to moving forward is certainly working very closely with our elected leaders, but also with the community at large, with our business community and with the residents in our community, because ultimately what we have to do is to define the priorities that are right for each individual community. And that ultimately is the genius of government in the United States. Each community gets to define its own direction, its own priorities, and its own way. As you hear from people from different communities, from California and Michigan, what will work in one community won't necessarily work in the other. What will be right in one community may not be the right answer in another community. And it's our job to help the people who live in our community and our elected officials arrive at that right set of priorities. So next, I'd like to turn the session over to Beth Keller to explore a little bit more deeply this looming issue around public sector pensions. Beth.
Thanks, Ron. I'm going to just give a brief overview of what's going on nationally with state and local plans, because local governments are often part of a state plan, but many of them have individual pension plans. The Center for State and Local Government Excellence published a study in April that was done in partnership with researchers at Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. And before we went into this recession in 2008, our pension levels in government, in state and local government, were funded on average above 80%, which most economists say is a good level. So just as private sector plans took a hit, public sector plans took a hit. And we tend to smooth in these losses or gains over a period of 5 years in the public sector. So today, that rather positive funding level of over 80% is now on average, in the aggregate, 78%. And by 2013, the aggregate funding level will be 72%. You might ask, what is going on in state and local governments given this reality? And what's happened in 2010 is we've had huge pension plan changes. We've seen states and localities reducing benefits for new employees. We're seeing higher employee contributions as a percent of salary. We're seeing more restrictions on retirement before the normal age and on retired people returning to covered services. Most of these changes are taking place within the framework of a defined benefit plan. But we did see in the case of Michigan and Utah that we've had defined benefit plans replaced with hybrid plans, which have, in addition to a pension base, also a defined contribution plan. So the reality is it looks quite different from state to state and from local government to local government. And on the whole, things are not bad and manageable, but some places have no problems at all. Some 10% of our pension plans are still over 80% funded. Unfortunately, that's matched on the other end with 11% that are under 60% funded, which you really don't want to have to be one of those plans in that circumstance. We know, therefore, that we're going to continue to see a lot of strains on budgets because of the need to get pension funding back to health. And I think that you'll see a lot of change coming ahead with new tiers of benefits, for example. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Darnell Early, ICMA's president.
Thank you, Beth. Well, first of all, let me just say that it is indeed an honor and a privilege to not only serve as ICMA president, but also to serve in a community that needs reinventing, and that I can take the resources from being ICMA president and use those as elements of my toolbox to address some of the real critical issues that we have in local government, not only in Michigan, but all over the country, but specifically as it relates to Michigan. This is an opportunity for many older Midwestern manufacturing cities who had ultimately always depended on the auto industry to reinvent themselves, because those days are gone. I mean, General Motors and the vibrancy of Ford and Chrysler, they did a lot of good not only for the region but for the whole country, but particularly the region like Detroit, Flint, and Saginaw, where I'm currently managing now, were the principal supporting areas for that industry. And, of course, as the industry collapsed, so did the supporting areas, i.e. the city of Saginaw, the city of Pontiac, Michigan, the city of Flint, Michigan. And so we're fortunate in Saginaw because of those three or four cities, Saginaw is the only one that is a pure council-manager form of government city. And what that means is that the city council elects a mayor, and together they hire a city manager. The city manager then has the responsibility for the day-to-day operations of the city, which means that a lot of the decisions that are made day-to-day and, of course, relative to the budget, come from a professional manager. Now, this is important because going forward in our ability to deal with the issues that we have to deal with, we're going to have to take a very close look at our revenues and expenditure pictures. We're going to have to take a close look, as Beth said, in terms of our ability to fund ongoing pension costs, which are in Michigan obligatory. We're going to have to take a look at the cost of providing public safety services, which in our case consumes approximately 75% of our general fund budget. And we're also going to have to take a look at the culture of our organizations in terms of the way things have always been done, the resistance to change, and the real rigid, if you will, positions that people in the community take about the familiarity they've always had with their government. Well, these times dictate that we can no longer do that. Our government has to take on a different posture, a different appearance, a different structure, something that looks more like Saginaw, Michigan in 2010, which is about 56,000 people, than Saginaw, Michigan in 1959 or 1960, which was closer to about 90,000. And so when we go through these exercises, we look for professionals not only in our unit of government, but our profession, rather, but we look for those who can help us take a look at our unit of government, provide some recommendations that are cost-saving, making our units of government more effective and more efficient, and also setting the blueprint, if you will, or the plan for the future of those organizations. And any one of those issues in and of itself would be a challenge, but certainly in Michigan, we have to put those all together, and our urban centers are where a lot of those issues are critical, because as goes, obviously, the city of Saginaw, so goes the county of Saginaw. As goes the city of Detroit, obviously, so goes the state of Michigan. So it's all pretty much intertwined. And so I think that as managers, what we've had to do is to recognize that and take those bold steps and propose those new initiatives in our efforts to make our communities more sustainable and to look more like what they will be required to look like in the coming years. Thank you.
Darnell, could you share with the people on the line just one specific example of what you've done to try to deal with the expenditure and revenue pressures in Saginaw?
One of the things that we did was we embarked upon a huge reorganization effort. And as it is with most older cities, when you find yourself in budget problems, you get across the board, you cut, you don't replace, you don't go back and consolidate. Generally, the focus and traditionally has been in Saginaw on just eliminating positions. And no one realized that the longer the organization goes without addressing those issues, the more entrenched it becomes in its inefficiency. We were able to learn from our independent study of our organization that there were many ways that we could do things. Now, I could have done that when I took the job in Saginaw some 5 years ago, but I needed the time to, first of all, see how the organization was coming together and to have someone else come in and share that perspective that they saw with mine, and together we came up with ways in which we went through each department and made significant reductions that eliminated us from having to make across-the-board reductions, because being proactive saved us money in the process. And so it also kept us from having to operate under a budget deficit. So that's very important. And it's also important to be willing to take those bold steps and taking a look at the organization.
All right, again, that was Darnell Early. He is the president of ICMA. Next, we're going to turn to John Johnson, who not only has experience in local government, but more recently he's been working with local governments across the country and assisting them in dealing with the financial crisis. John, what advice are you giving and what are you seeing?
Thanks, Ron. I think that I'm in a fortunate position where I can begin to see what's happening across the United States with local governments. Having served as a budgeting and finance practitioner for almost 30 years in various jurisdictions, I can clearly see that this is an unprecedented time, that we're not going to recover to the levels that we have seen before, and we must adapt to what has been called the new normal. It may be a trite phrase, but I think it's a realistic phrase that describes the fact that we must start looking at ways to still become relevant as local governments to our citizens, but we've got to take into consideration the values and the priorities that they have in terms of what are the services that are most important to them, and how do I identify those. This is a long-term solution to our budgeting issues. Normally, governments have taken an incremental approach to budget increases. That's something that isn't going to work in this new normal. They've also approached something that's across the board that maybe could get us through the short term, but will not address the long-term need to reach those new levels of financial sustainability and financial resiliency in our own local organizations. So we've seen that a new approach that many governments across the country are starting to look at very seriously is a priority-based budgeting approach, that this is an important area in which we involve the organization to determine what are those strategic priorities, what are the things that make us relevant as an organization, and what are the things that we are expected to provide to those citizens using their valuable tax dollars. We know that we have to take this conversation from just looking at what are those priorities, what are those results that our community wants, but we have to evaluate them against the programs and services that we offer. It's a new step in government to not talk at the department level, but to really start looking at the individual programs and services that are offered. In the city of San Jose, when they approached it this way, they found out that they had almost 600 programs that needed to be evaluated. Government is a diverse group of operations, and we offer many, many things. And even the smallest of organizations, Blue Ash, Ohio, a small community in the Cincinnati area, has almost 200 programs that they offer their citizens. So it's important to have the conversation, not are police more important than libraries, but certainly what programs that each of those departments offer help us achieve the priorities that are the highest need and highest interest to our citizens. So the work begins with many of these organizations in first identifying those programs, coming down with that vigorous program inventory list so that there's a clear understanding internally and externally what they do. Then there needs to be a process that helps them evaluate, here are the things that we do, how important are they, how critical are they in achieving the results that we're trying to accomplish. And so that process allows you to come up with a scoring of each program that continues to show which programs are achieving our highest priorities and which programs may not be achieving those priorities or may not be as relevant as they were when that program was first started years ago. But when the tough decisions come, we need to understand that across-the-board budget cuts, as someone said, preserves mediocrity in all programs, where we want to be sure that we can find the top programs, those that most importantly help us achieve our results. Find out what those are. And as Ron pointed out, each community's programs may be different. What's important in one community, in the work that we've found from Walnut Creek, California, to Grand Island, Nebraska, Chesapeake, Virginia, Monterey, California, and Fort Collins, Colorado, their priorities are very different. And so we find out what those priorities are, determine what programs and services most help that city influence those priorities, and then we're able to find ways to allocate resources to the highest priorities and divest ourselves of those programs that are least accomplishing those priorities, so that it's a transparent process that citizens can see our goal is to move dollars from the lowest priorities to those things that are less important to them and start funding those areas which are of the highest importance. The key to this priority-based budgeting is that it is transparent, and it's a way that you can understand when a program does achieve the highest priority, why is that happening, and a program that does not achieve the priority, that you can see clearly why it has reached that level in the prioritization process.
Thank you, John. The details of the methodology and approach that John just discussed is an example of the kind of education sessions that we're offering at the ICMA conference this year. He and his colleague Chris did two half-day workshops over the weekend. Part of our purpose in holding our annual conference is to get managers together to share best practices, to learn from one another so that we can go back and do what we need to do in our individual communities. To hear more about what's happening in another individual community is Linda Barton again. She is the city manager of Livermore, California. I would say a state that has been as challenged as any.
Yes, absolutely. Livermore is a community of about 90,000 people located in the San Francisco Bay Area, the East Bay. The unemployment rate in our area currently is over 10.5%. The assessed valuations have declined by hundreds of millions of dollars throughout our communities. And Livermore's structural deficit going into the 2010-11 year is estimated at $5.5 million and $6.5 million in the 11-12 year. So clearly we were facing major and important challenges that were going to affect the type of community we have and, most importantly, the kind of services that we could provide. We have been going through a process of budget reductions for several years in California and probably around the country, and have eliminated positions, done layoffs, merged departments, increased our use of volunteers. Our employees have not taken salary increases and, in fact, have picked up a portion of the cost of their benefits. But as we were going into this next two-year budget cycle, we realized that we had to continue to do even more. We did several things because we realized that our business had to be done differently. As Darnell indicated, we couldn't just keep doing business the same way. We had to look at how we did it and how we could continue to do it in more effective and efficient ways. So we created some cross-departmental teams in our organization, and we assigned them the responsibility to look at some of the key areas where we thought we could make a difference. And so those teams are streamlining, which is ways looking at ways to sell our services or share our services with other communities, volunteerism, greening principles, information technology, and ways to reduce the size of our organization and our services. Those teams have come up with a variety of recommendations, including the fact that we now sell plan review and inspection services to one of the national laboratories in our community. We are working with a neighboring community to combine police SWAT teams. We have a new volunteer recruitment website and database and process so that the entire community can join with us. We are maximizing our travel and training funds by doing a lot more virtual conferencing. And we have created ways to defer some of our fleet replacement. But most importantly, these are saving us money. These are helping us do our business better. But we really have changed the culture of our organization. Our employees now look at what they're doing and how they can do it better, whether that is one of the assigned topics or whether it's just a smart thing to do. And we are really seeing the results of that as we go into the budget reductions that we have to make. Even more importantly, one of the things that we've done as we've had to make these reductions is to focus on our core services. Our direction all along has been to continue to provide quality core services in our community and reduce or eliminate those things that are nice to have or not part of our core services. We also held some community engagement workshops and did those around the community so that they would be convenient for people, and basically challenged them to work with us, laid out the scenario, and asked for their suggestions for making the reductions, and heard from them where their priorities were, and also those areas that they felt if they had to make a tough choice, they could. I think one of the real benefits of that was the fact that our community really began to understand the depth of the problem that we were dealing with. Ultimately, we have closed a fire station and a branch library. We've reduced landscape maintenance, planning and building inspection fees. We've eliminated 9 police officer positions and demoted 3 senior officers. So clearly we have gone broadly across the services that we provide, but we've tried to do it in a very directed and clear way so that our core services, again, would be maintained. And then I would be remiss not to mention pension reform, because that is a huge issue in California as well. Livermore has been a part of a 2-county process with Alameda and Contra Costa County to develop a white paper, and it is the goal of each of the cities in these 2 counties to make significant changes going forward in our pension system, including all employees paying the full share of their cost, a second-tier system for new employees in our organization, and pensions based on the 3 highest years as opposed to the single highest year. We think that these will make a difference going forward, and we are working very hard through our negotiating processes to achieve those. We are also reaching out to our community. We have 2 national laboratories, and we are hoping that more businesses will be developed with the incredible science that they are developing within their parameters and develop a stronger economy going forward, because we know it's up to us, if it's going to get better, to make things better. So we have worked on right-sizing, doing our business differently, focusing on core service, and building our business sector based on high technology.
Thank you, Linda. Now we'll turn to Chris Fabian, partner with John Johnson. Share with us what he's seeing among other local governments as well. Chris?
Thanks a lot, Ron. As John and I have worked across the country over the last few years, one of the things that's been so apparent is that while focusing on priorities, while focusing on right-sizing, this all seems so logical. When it comes down to it, none of this is easy. Finding a solution in this environment is so challenging. And I'm going to start with a story to illustrate what we're all facing. And this started when John and I were first working together on what is this priority-based budgeting going to look like. And we came to a conclusion point where we had all the programs ordered in their list of how they influence the community's priorities. Everything fit. It seemed logical. But then it came time to making a budget decision. And we were in the council's chambers in this community. And what happened was we were focusing on the last place program that we had, and it was a 4-H program in our community. And as our commissioners were so proud of what we had done in prioritization, what happened was the 4-H constituents came into council chambers and said, this is not the program that we think is last place. In fact, we think this is the most important thing that we do. So our Board of County Commissioners, so confident in the work that they'd done and so proud of it, looked up at the prioritized list and they said, We hear you. We understand it. But here's the work that we've done. We've really focused on priorities. We've ranked our programs. And would you rather see that we cut a program like police patrol in order to preserve your program in 4-H? And they could see that. They could say, okay, we understand why that program's of the top priority, but we still feel our program is so important. What are we going to do? And the commissioner said, well, okay, what do we do next? We can't. Can we possibly raise fees for your program? And the 4-H'er said, we're very poor. You don't understand our constituency, and raising fees is not the answer as well. Okay, so what are we going to do? Well, what they focused on in the end, this was a program that was dedicated to, it had equestrian nature, taking care of horses on a fairgrounds operation as part of the 4-H program. And they took care of stables, they took care of barns. And what the parents decided to do, they went back, they regrouped, and it turned out that they got their kids in the program, who are the main customers of the program, to come in and take over some of the maintenance of the fencing, do some of the summer season labor work, thereby reducing the county's need to hire seasonal contract workers, also reducing the cost of the program, and the community stepped up to take a part in preserving the program. It was a win-win. The county cut its budget, but the citizens stepped up to take advantage of the program. And one of the main points I wanted to make, this is something that we're seeing in all of our work, is that part of the new paradigm is not treating the citizens as our customers in local government, but really treating them as our partners. Another example of this, there was a very similar story, was in Walnut Creek, California, near the San Francisco Bay Area as well. And when they came to the end of their prioritization work, a popular program about taking citizens on history tours in their community went to the bottom of the list. Well, what happened? The city needed to cut it. It made sense. It was towards the bottom of their priority list. But a group of citizens came forward, and they started a nonprofit to take over history tours. There were some retired folks. They were very proud of the work. So the city cuts its budget. Citizens step up. They create a new program, very creative, and it's win-win. This is very exciting. Point number 2 that I wanted to make, that we're seeing in our work is the city's abilities to change the conversation, inviting citizens to take part in a discussion about not what we want to cut in our community, but what we really want to keep. We've heard in this discussion a relentless focus on what are these foundational results that make our governments relevant. We're seeing so many cities take that on right now and say, if we disappeared tomorrow, would anybody notice? Well, of course they would, but why? What are those foundational results that make us relevant as an organization? And bringing that discussion to the citizens, citizens are really good at talking about what they want to keep. It's those opportunities where they get up on the soapbox to talk about what they want to cut. That's very difficult to engage citizens in that conversation. John and I were just in Monterey, California, and as they engaged the community in what they want to keep, we saw something marvelous happen. A policeman and a fireman from the city interpreted what the citizens had responded to about what they thought made up a safe community, and there we saw the police and the fire not telling the community what they thought made up a safe community or how they defined public safety, but interpreting what they thought they heard from the citizens about what a safe community meant to them. And now they're going to respond to that. Citizens are really good at talking about what they want to keep and then taking that active role. So those are the two main points that I wanted to share, the two conversation points, citizens as our partners in our community, not our customers, and focusing on what we want to keep rather than what we want to cut.
Thank you so much, Chris. You also illustrate a really important point. Sometimes people look at all the programs that we have in government. I think John listed a community with 600 different programs. The reality is there's a constituency behind every one of those programs, and that's why priority setting is so difficult. I said in the beginning of my comments that managers were approaching this from the long view and really trying to take this crisis as an opportunity to make their communities more sustainable. Darnell and Linda, both of you have been through some really challenges within your community. I don't think anyone would envy what you've been going through. As you look at where you've been and where you're going, are you depressed? Are you pessimistic? You know, what do you see on the horizon for Saginaw and Livermore? Darnell?
Well, at the onset, let me just say that I'm very optimistic despite the high degree of pushback that I've received in Saginaw over the last 2 years that we've been going through this process. And I think part of that conditioning came from the fact that I also served as city administrator in Flint, Michigan, where we had to do some similar things. So my experience and work has been in distressed communities and looking at these issues of change and reform of some systems that are quite inefficient and ineffective at a time when they need to be more effective and more efficient. So I'm very optimistic, and just as I said earlier, it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to improve quality of life. I think it's an opportunity to deliver services in a more innovative and a more efficient manner. And it's a challenge, no question but that it is a challenge, and I think that challenge is met more successfully when the attitude is tethered, if you will, to the good resources that not only ICMA but our strategic partners who provide consulting services bring to the table. We're just the instruments as managers, and you know, this is a much higher calling, I think, that puts us in situations where we have to go into some very hostile environments and just change cultures, and that's not easy. But I believe that there are resources out there, and there are a lot of people who are the silent majority who want to see change. And so those are the ones we also have to mobilize and engage. So the short answer to your question, I'm very optimistic.
What about Livermore?
Well, I would have to say that this has been an extremely painful and difficult process for all of us to go through. And I think in our organization, people feel very badly about those who have been laid off, who are no longer part of our organization. But in the end, I believe that we are going to continue to be a stronger organization. I think we have incorporated a culture of looking at the ways we do our work and constantly focusing on better and more effective ways to do that. I think that we are working towards and achieving financial stability going forward. And I'm very optimistic about our longer-range goals, bringing transit and research and development corporations and companies in partnership with our labs to our community. So in the end, I think we will be a stronger organization. The state of California is a wonderful, innovative place, and I think we will all take advantage of that. And with newer and better ways to do our work, I think we will come out of this successfully.
Thank you so much. Michael, we'll be happy to take questions at this point.
And Megan, if you could provide the listeners instructions for how they can queue up if they have any questions to ask of our speakers.
Absolutely. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please keep in mind that you may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. And it looks like our first question will come from the site of Stephen Fair with Stateline. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. When Beth Keller was talking about the unfunded liability, the figures used were 80% before 2008, currently 78%, and by 2013, 72%. When you look at those numbers, that might suggest that a lot of the reforms that have been enacted in the last few years aren't saving that much money.
Yes, let me clarify that the decline would go to 72% if we didn't have these reforms. So the point here is that governments that are able and disciplined and stepping up to fund their plans will get back to healthy funding with increased contributions, often from both the employer and the employee.
Okay, I didn't understand that. Thanks.
Yeah, sorry.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, it is star and 1 on your touchtone phone. And it looks like our next question comes from the site of Tom Barnrich with Contra Costa Times. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. You talked earlier about establishing priorities and how they are different community to community. How can you be sure that the priorities are actually reflecting what the community wants?
John?
In our work, we have developed ways in which we not only engage the organization themselves, the elected officials, but we also have ways in which the community has been brought in. Walnut Creek, California is a prime example of opening up the conversation to bring citizens in to help confirm and validate the results that have been set by the city, but also to go through a process that helps us also define those results. And we think that part of the prioritization process not only helps you identify that you want to provide, for example, a safe community, but you want to be sure that it's clear what does that safe community mean. And in many organizations, we find that the citizens believe a safe community goes beyond just typical police and fire services, but they are talking about things like code enforcement, public health, restaurant inspections, things that make you feel safe in your community. And so what we really try to do is encourage communities in the long term to continue to find ways to engage the citizens in the conversation of what does this priority mean and how can we achieve it so that they are partners in determining what those priorities are for their community.
Linda, could you just talk about a little bit of what you've done in Livermore to make sure you really are tapping into what your residents really want and care about?
Absolutely. One of the things that we do on a biannual basis is a citizen survey. We ask citizens what their thoughts are on all of the services that we provide and also where their priorities are. And we see trends over time and try to respond to those and reflect those as a part of both the council's goals that are set every 2 years as well as our budget process. We also try very hard to get a lot of information out on a regular basis to our community. We do a two-page document that's called the Budget in Brief that gives the person who doesn't have the time to sit and look through our hundreds of pages of budget information a quick snapshot of where the priorities are, where we're spending the money, and what kinds of services they are receiving for those dollars. We also try to focus in our budget on the outcomes that come from the dollars that are spent. So we think we're doing a pretty good job of making sure that the information is out there and hearing back from our community what they think about it.
Yeah, I would just add that one of the major themes within ICMA itself that we're trying to push out to our local governments as a leading practice is the importance of citizen engagement. And that means a lot more than just having public hearings on the budget. If you just take that approach, you don't know what you're tapping into. It's going to be very self-selected. So being much broader, like the citizen surveys that Linda's using, which we strongly encourage, but also going out in the community and having forums using Web 2.0, strategies, getting at the micro level as much as you can to ensure that you're getting a real cross-section and the full diversity of your community, not just selected special interests, is one of the most important things to do. Chris, you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I was just going to add, we were in Blue Ash, Ohio, as a small community outside of Cincinnati, and one thing that their city council recognized, looking towards the long view, as you talked about, Ron, was that it's not enough just to engage the citizens groups that they're used to seeing at city council meetings. They actually went into the high schools and talked about, in the civics classes, what is this community going to look like in the next 10 years, and how do we keep these kids here? So it's engaging all aspects of the community is what I wanted to get back to your point for now and into the future.
So any follow-up question there? Good. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Do we have another question in the queue?
We have no further questions at this time, but as a reminder, it is star and one to register to ask a question. And it looks like we do have a question from the site of Betsy Sherman.
Yes.
And it looks like she is with the Local Government Matters. Your line is open.
Thank you. I'd like to ask, are local government employees delaying their retirement because of the recession?
This is Elizabeth Keller with the Center for State and Local Government Excellence, and we have done online surveys of human resource managers in the last year, and in fact, in most places, we found that local government employees are delaying their plans to retirement. We did find an exception in California where there was actually an increase in the number of people putting in for retirement, but it's in general, we're finding that it goes the other way, that most people are trying to rebuild their nest eggs.
Yes, I think if I worked in California and could retire, I might as well.
Why you can't.
Yeah, exactly. Do we have any other questions in the queue?
We have no further questions at this time.
All right. We want to thank you all very much for joining us today, and we appreciate your interest in local government. If you have any follow-up questions, Michael will give you the specifics on how to contact us so that we can try to be responsive to you. The bottom line is that as professional managers, we are very much trying to look beyond election cycles, look beyond individual special interest, and take the long view to really get our governments on a firm financial ground so that not only are we financially sustainable, but we also achieve the kind of communities where people are proud to live, proud to work, and proud to play. Again, we thank you very much for joining us. Michael, what do people need to do if they have follow-up questions?
Thanks, Ron, and thanks to all of you for joining us. For any follow-up questions, if you have anything else you'd like to ask of today's speakers or to learn more about the ICMA annual conference going on in San Jose, please contact Michelle Frisbee, ICMA's Director of Public Information, and her phone is 301-646-1918, or you can email her at M as in Michelle Frisbee, F as in Frank, R-I, S as in Sam, B-Y at ICMA.org. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, and again, thanks to everyone for joining us today. Please enjoy the rest of your day.